I mean the
today is Wednesday.
The
end of June.
The 30th of June.
It may be the 29th. Shall I look it up?
No, that's all right. That's
I
fine.
I have a calendar in
I'll
the kitchen.
Make sure I double check it. And I'm Natalie Peters. I'm here with Rosa Crocker, and we're just going to talk about Harvard County History 1994. Okay. Okay, and what brought you to Harvard County? What's that there?
I married a Harvard Countyan.
Mm-hmm. And that would be Michael Crocker.
Michael Pugh Crocker. And I was welcomed here by all of his relatives and friends. Most of them were, everybody was lovely to me when I came here. And I arrived with a ready-made set of friends and relatives.
Tell me how you met your husband.
My father was the track coach at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia. And I grew up watching boys run around the track and put the shot and throw the javelin and hurdle and everything. My husband was on the team from 1936 to 1940, so he was one of the track boys.
And then you met him there, and were you also attending Washington Lee? Or?
No, there were no girls there then.
Oh, that's right. No, of course not. I stand corrected. Did you attend a university?
I went to Vassar College. I'm 2 years younger than my husband.
And then you came to Harford County in what year?
We were married in 1945, even before World War II was quite over. And the atom bomb dropped, the war ended. My husband was in the Pacific Theater with the Marines. And as soon as the war was over, he entered the University of Virginia Law School. He had had a year of night law school before the war, and he was eager to finish. So we were married and went to law school together in Charlottesville. And as soon as he graduated, which was 2.5 years later, we moved to Baltimore, lived in an apartment on Park Avenue. He got a job at the law firm of Marbury, Miller, and Evans, which later became Piper and Marbury. And he stayed with them for 37 years.
And what were you doing at the time when you moved to Baltimore? Did you have children at that time? Or?
No, because we had just been married. And in those days, you didn't have children before you were married.
No, of course not.
Most people didn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's so different now.
Tell me about some of those changes.
Some of them are good. Some are not. I think women have many more opportunities now than they did, and so do black people. And other minorities, many more opportunities, and are not looked down on. We did not, when I was growing up in Virginia, we did not look down on black people at all, but we recognized that they didn't have as much education, and they mostly earned their living by manual labor. Now, their opportunities are so greatly increased, and it's just wonderful. And that may seem like a long time to you, but it really isn't.
And what other changes have you seen since
in Harford County?
Overall, since your first time coming to this area, Baltimore area too? What was Baltimore like when you first moved
in? To me, I remember thinking, Baltimore is a city that is resting on its laurels. It had a very wonderful past history. Lots of great things had happened there. Not to mention the fact that it was a real social center, as well as economic, agricultural, trade, commerce, education, a center for educational institutions. But it was it was sitting there resting on its laurels to me as an outside observer. But it very shortly started to change and is still doing that. Many improvements have been made. Not only just the physical improvements around the Inner Harbor as a perfect example of lots of better things, but coming into the 20th century, you might say, looking to the future, paying attention to what's going on now and what people need now to live, instead of just dwelling on the past. I was a history major in college, so was my husband, and so was Aunt Orbefina. So we're really into history. But I admired my mother so much because one of her characteristics was she did not live in the past, and she lived to be almost 94 years old. She was always up to date, thinking about how things are now, what people need to do to solve their problems, how to improve their lives. That's one reason so many young people liked her, because she was interested in what they were doing, very much so, and they all enjoyed being with her. I really admired that in her.
Can you describe what Baltimore was like when you first came here? What were the things that you remember most, the physical features?
Well, having grown up in a small town in Virginia, it was the first major city I had lived in, not counting my wartime service in San Francisco.
I'd like to hear about that too.
And wartime service in Washington, D.C. That was, I had two war jobs. I was not in military service. I applied, but was turned down. They told me that my civilian job was so important that they would not release me to join the military service.
And what was your civilian job?
I was a code clerk for the Army Air Force. It was called then Army Air Corps.
My grandfather was a colonel.
And my job was to encode and decode secret and confidential messages for that branch of the Air Corps, which was known as the Air Transport Command. And they transported personnel, cargo, mail, and planes. They ferried them.
How did you get that position? How did you first get interested?
Oh, everybody was helping with the war effort the minute it started. Everybody just figured out as fast as possible what he could do to help the war effort. And that's why we won, because we pulled together and we didn't give up. And we had a wonderful leader in Franklin Roosevelt. I just applied and was accepted. And I worked at Gravelly Point, which is the national airport in Washington, and then was sent to the station at Hamilton Field outside of San Francisco. From there, we took care of messages going down into the South Pacific for planes, cargo, mail, and personnel.
And how long were you in San Francisco?
About a year. I lived in San Rafael. One of the exciting things that happened while I was working there, have you ever heard of Captain Eddie Rickenbacker?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was downed at sea with his crew, and when he was finally rescued, they floated around in the ocean for, oh, maybe 3 weeks or a long time. Some of them died. He was rescued and brought back to our airfield, and I was on duty when he arrived and looked out the window and saw them unloading that plane with him and his crew. Captain Rickenbacker walked off of that plane holding his head high, even though he was in terrible physical condition. But he was the leader, and he walked on. The others were carried on stretchers, or limped, or on crutches, or something like that. Not Rickenbacker. That was inspiring. It really was. Then I was sent to Gravely Point.
In Washington.
In Washington, that's right. And there, of course, our the messages that we were sending from our code room involved the air traffic to the European theater, Newfoundland, England, and so forth.
And this was about 1941?
No.
1942?
We didn't end the war until December 7th, 1941. It was in 42 and 43. And after about 2 years of that job, I changed to the American Red Cross Hospital Recreation Service. That involved being trained in Alexandria and being sent to, they sent me back to California. I worked at Camp Roberts, California, which was an infantry replacement training center. My uncle, who was in the Army, had been commander of that base very shortly before I got there, so I didn't have the advantage of having an uncle as a commander. I just had to. I was sorry. Our job was to provide hospital recreation for the patients, who were an amazing mix. We had Italian prisoners of war who were so happy to be there. They just loved being prisoners of war because they had a safe bed and good food and easy work. They shipped them out in trucks every day to the firing range, and they had to clean up the police up the area and do things like that. But it was not anything like hard labor, and they were safe from the war. They were so glad to stop fighting. That was one group. But the majority of the men there, and they were mostly men, although there were some women in the Women's Army Corps and nurses, were training for infantry replacement assignment. So that was men taking the basic training, and women, some women too. Then another group, entirely different, were the veterans, the old soldiers coming back from the Pacific who had been at war over there for many months, sometimes years. They all looked yellow, not because they had taken on Oriental cast, but because they had to take Adabrin to prevent, what does Adabrin prevent? Yellow fever or malaria, one of those tropical diseases.
Now, these men weren't really that much older than the men that were going.
No, not physically. Not physically, but they had been to war, and the others were just marching around learning how to turn right and left and make up their beds and shoot their guns. Quite different.
Did these men interact with one another?
I don't know too much. They were certainly not. Their assignments were not together. So,
do you remember any individuals from that? Any special people that stood
in out? My photograph album, I have pictures. Sure do.
So you made some friends in the, with the people coming through there.
Not permanent friends, no. But you certainly felt a great admiration for these people and desire to do anything you could to ease their life. That's what the Red Cross was for. And my job was hospital recreation. So we showed movies, and sometimes we would write letters for people who were bedbound. Or we'd go shopping for them at the PX because their girl was coming and they wanted to have a box of candy for her. That seems
trivial, but nothing was trivial for them. Anything that would help them get well and raise their morale, that was our top goal.
Tell me about writing those letters. That must have been quite an experience.
Well, I can't remember many details. And if they couldn't write, you know, they still wanted a letter to go home.
Do you remember if that was ever really difficult for you?
No.
What they had to say must have
been. Not at all. Mm-hmm. You just did whatever you could for them. Mm-hmm. But that's a good question. It could have been.
So then you came back to the East Coast after that, after your time in California.
My mother wrote to me. My father had had a stroke. And my mother wrote to me and she said, if you want to see your father again, get yourself transferred east. So I did, and was stationed next and last at McGuire General Hospital outside of Richmond, Virginia. And that was an entirely different setup. The patients at McGuire were battle casualties from Europe. They had been brought in by a hospital ship and unloaded in Norfolk and transferred to hospital trains and shipped straight from Norfolk to Richmond, a very easy, quick trip. So our hospital had two specialties. That was, we had orthopedic cases and neurologic cases. So the place was swarming with people walking around on crutches with casts and, you know, on their arms and legs and everything. And then plates in their heads, if they had had serious brain injuries, they would put plates in their heads. They, I think, were the bravest men I've ever met, because they bucked each other up. They were all there together. They had this common experience. They joked and teased each other, and I think that was a typical military way for them to get along. And what we had to do was so small by comparison to what they had done. So it was a real privilege to be able to be in a setting like that and to be any help at all. We played games with them, cards, you know, whatever they wanted to do. I remember I was at the front desk of the Red Cross wing, and I heard a very deep voice at my elbow say, I was sitting there holding the phone, waiting for Ward 17 or something to answer to say whether they wanted me to bring them a movie that afternoon. And this voice said, what's the matter, honey? Won't he answer? And it was Walter Pidgeon, who had come there to put on a show of some sort.
Did you have a conversation with him? Or?
Sure.
And you recognized him immediately?
Right. At Camp Roberts, California, I was in a soldier's show, Girl Crazy, by Gershwin. And the lead was taken by Red Skelton, who was taking his basic training at Camp Roberts at that time. And he was one good sport. He came to rehearsal on time. He never gave any back talk to the director. He just did it and did it well. And every night, the show ran for 10 nights. Every night, his jokes were different. He was so clever, so that the cast was broken up, as well as the audience. You can imagine. Mm-hmm.
Did you get to know him more so outside the...
No. There wasn't time. So then, but that was fun.
Yeah. It sounds like it. After your time at Richmond, then what happened?
My husband came home from the Pacific, and we decided to get married, and we were married. Well, the Iwo Jima campaign was his last. That was in February. He came home in May. We were married in June, with the expectation that he would have 1 month's leave at home after having been overseas for over 3 years. He was to go back to be in the force that was designed to invade the mainland of Japan. That was going to be the final blow, the final strike to close out this miserable business, and that's what they were planning for. He didn't have to do that after all, because Harry Truman dropped the bomb.
Tell me about that. Tell me what it was like for you all to hear about the news of the bomb drop.
Well, it was a closely kept secret, and it was totally unexpected. Not only was it a bomb, but it was an atom bomb. No, there hadn't been any before, certainly not used in combat. I can't remember whether we knew that they were being tested or not. I was not aware that it was being developed or tested. You know, when the headlines of the paper were a mile high, atom bomb dropped. Was it Hiroshima or Nagasaki first? It was Hiroshima first. Right. People walked around the streets. We were living in Fredericksburg, Virginia at the time. He was stationed at Quantico, being retrained to go back to the Pacific. And people just wandered around the streets, just jubilant, solemn, both, you know, couldn't believe the news, but overjoyed. Now, Japan didn't give up with the bomb on Hiroshima. The next bomb was therefore dropped a week later on Nagasaki, and then they gave up. And high time, after all the damage they had done, all the misery they had caused, all the casualties. The younger generation who doesn't live through this doesn't remember what it really was like. But I have talked with my children, our children and their friends from time to time. They emphasize how terrible it was to drop the atom bomb on those innocent people. Well, it was terrible. But we had to stop that war. We had to stop those Japanese from trying to conquer the world. You would have done the same thing, I'm sure. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I certainly do. So tell me what that week was like between the bombs. Do you remember?
No.
Just that feeling of jubilation and sorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And then your husband would have gotten the news that he didn't have to go back.
Right. It was almost immediately decided that, anybody who wanted to be discharged could be. And he chose that right away. And this was August, and law school started in September.
And he enrolled for that?
University of Virginia, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And then what did you do at that time?
I applied for another job and was employed as a secretary to the Dean of Counseling. That was interesting because many of the students who came through our office were discharged veterans wanting to go back to school under the GI Bill, which was a tremendous thing. It made it possible for all the returning soldiers who wanted to continue and complete their education to do so. I think it was one of the finest, most imaginative acts of Congress that I have ever known about. It just changed the lives of millions of young men and women who might have been at a terrible loss, you know, suddenly back on the job market, and there were an awful lot of them. So that was a very creative piece of legislation, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Fitting piece of legislation.
I know.
And then after that, your husband...
After he graduated, then we moved, came to Baltimore. He had an interview at a firm in Baltimore. He went for an interview in West Virginia and one or two other places. But he decided to accept the offer from Marbury, Miller, and Evans law firm in Baltimore.
Do you remember your first impression of Baltimore when you first came there?
It needed paint. It needed cleaning up. So much depends on where you're looking from. I was looking from the point of view of a young married woman who was new to the area. I knew some of the glories of their institutions like Johns Hopkins and Peabody and so forth. My mother had gone to Johns Hopkins Hospital Nursing School before World War I. What do you think of that? Isn't that amazing? And learned a lot. She didn't graduate, but she learned a lot. Well, girls weren't doing that sort of thing very much in those days, especially coming from another state. Mm-hmm. And she was from the sort of family where she would ordinarily have been expected to make her debut and get married. She didn't make her debut, but she did get married, and she married a Yankee.
What a scandal.
He was from Chicago. And she lived in Lexington, Virginia with her family, and my father came there on the physical education faculty and was the track coach. And he was very attractive, and he was different. He wasn't one of these slow-moving, slow-talking Southern gentlemen. He was a doer from Notre Dame University and had been on the American Olympic team in 1912. So I asked her how she met him. She was quite a belle, I gather, from hearing people talk. She said, well, one afternoon, he invited me one Sunday afternoon to go for a buggy ride. That's how you, one way you entertained your girl. And I said, where did you go? She said, well, I asked him to drive past Jenny Hopkins' house. I said, who was Jenny Hopkins? Was one of my mother's best friends. Because my father had taken Jenny out before that. And then mother said, and he didn't take her out anymore after that.
Your mother sounds like a very clever woman. So what was it like being a young married couple in Baltimore when you first came there? What did you do?
Well, my husband walked to work. It was 10 or 12 blocks, I would say. I got a job at the University of Maryland Medical School with an obstetrician, a woman obstetrician, who spent most of her time delivering babies from poor families in the neighborhood of the hospital. I remember interviewing one young pregnant woman, asking her the required questions such as your age, how many children do you have, and the father. And this one woman, young woman, said, I got four children, one by my first husband, two by the man I'm living with now, and one of my own. That's on the record, but that's what she said. One day, one of the other gals who worked in our office came running in and she said, you always said you wanted to observe a delivery. There's one about to happen now over in delivery room number so-and-so. And they said that if you put on a mask and gown, you can come. Well, I was just dying to go. I'd never seen that. And working there, you know, would make you interested. But my boss said, I'm sorry, but I've got to get these letters out before the day closes, and I'm sorry. So I didn't get to go. That's all right.
So you never did see a delivery there?
No.
That must have been an interesting position on any
level. Well, she was a wonderful person. Her name was Margaret Ballard. She was about 5 feet tall, I'm sure, no more than that.
It was unusual to have female obstetricians at that time, wasn't it?
Well,
they weren't that common.
The war was a big turning point for women. There's no question about that. They had to do all kinds of things that they had never done before to get the job done, to get the war won. Rosie the Riveter is a prototype. And females in the armed services, you see, that was a big new thing. There'd always been nurses, but the women's.
Your observations on how the war changed things for women?
Changed them a lot, I think. I grew up in a small college town with a very close-knit family and circle of friends as a faculty child, which gives you a sense that, you know, a sense of security. And you know who you are and everybody else. You know who everybody else is and they know who you are. And you can't get away with much because they know you. But by the same token, it gives added stability to your life and security, emotional security. Well, the war just turned everything topsy-turvy. People, first thing of all happened, people moved away. They moved to where the war plants were. They joined the service. They went overseas. They went across the country, back and forth and up and down, and mobilizing to win this war. That was on everybody's mind. Unconditional defeat was our goal of Hitler and Japan, and we were absolutely determined to do that. There was very, very little disagreement, and that's one of the reasons it was so successful. It was tremendously hard work. It was horribly expensive in money and lives, but you know, we did it. And therefore, having experienced that, we find it hard to understand how younger people who have not had the same point of view don't seem to share that understanding or determination. So I'm glad to have a chance to say there was a great unity in the country, I think.
Tell me what your response to the deterioration of that unity, say Vietnam, 20 years later. What was your response and your observation on that?
Well, I can remember thinking people were very, very bitterly and clearly divided on whether we should be there in the first place. What business was it of ours to go over there and do that? Was, you know, one point of view. But the other point of view was, we have got to defeat communism wherever it is. It was no joke. It was a very serious worldwide threat. And some people felt, and the ones who got us into the war, that we had to stop it wherever we could. That was a genuine feeling. All around us were people who were running away to Canada to avoid military service. Some of them were doing it for high moral reasons. I am perfectly willing to acknowledge that. Others just, you know, didn't think it was our business and weren't about to get involved. It was quite a division. And coming so soon after the unity, of World War II. Of course, we had the Korean War in between, hadn't we? That was more of a unified national effort, I would say, the Korean War. And based on exactly the same thing, the defeat of communism. And I remember saying to some people who were arguing about whether we had any business being in Vietnam, they said, well, we can't win. And as it turned out, we couldn't. Or we didn't. I'm sure we could have if we'd had a unified national will to do so. But I remember replying to that, yes, but we certainly can lose.
And in retrospect, did we lose, in your opinion?
No. No, there were some very useful things that came out of that. One of the most unuseful was the spread of the use of drugs. That's when it really took off like wildfire, and we're suffering from that till today. That's when it started in Vietnam. So many soldiers had access to the drugs and just got hooked on them.
Did you see that in World War II at all, drug use?
No. Oh, it must have been there, but we were hardly aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
In World War II, when you said drugs, you meant medicine.
Not the same prevalence at all then.
Abuse would have been alcohol. It's always been, you know, that problem.
So give me your view on some of the other changes that our country and our county have gone through in the time since you've been making these astute observations.
I'm always happy to see young people who have a sense of responsibility to their communities. That's how we were brought up. If you lived in a place, you needed to contribute to the common good. And it didn't make much difference how, as long as you were helping other people. And not just going home to your house in your car, shutting your door, looking at your television, eating your wonderful food, going to work the next day, and paying no attention to the needs and requirements of your neighbors.
How did Harford County stand up to that standard when you got here?
When I got here, there were 39,000 residents, and it was a rural, basically a rural place. Agriculture, in one form or another, was a very large basis of employment and the proving ground.
Can you describe it to me? What do you remember most about the physical features?
Well, one thing I noticed right away was how more people here had their fences painted than in Virginia, where I grew up. Where there was a lot more, I think it was a combination in Virginia of more poverty and a laxer attitude toward neatness. We are perilously close to the Pennsylvania Dutch ethic and people, and they wouldn't think of having an unpainted fence up there, or an unmown lawn, or a broken barn door. Would they? No. In Virginia, all the time. But we were happy. And we helped each other. It was just quite a different outlook. But now when I go back to Virginia, I cannot help. One of the first things I notice is the lawns are mowed, the fences are mended, the houses are painted. There's not much trash around. I don't know whether it's that Pennsylvania Dutch influence that crept south, or whether they just are more prosperous and see that it is nicer that way.
But Harford County already knew that when you got here.
I was safe. That's right. People were lovely to me. I really appreciated the warm reception that I got as a bride of a native Harford County. I longed for my mountains. I missed those mountains. I ached for them. And we would be riding around the countryside and somebody would say, oh, look at that lovely view. And the view they were talking about consisted of nice pastures and woods and cows grazing. And to me, a view was the Blue Ridge Mountains.
And so describe again, tell me some more details of what you're remembering about Harford County at that time. Mostly pasture, is that right? It was mostly pasture?
Small communities. They're all still here, mm-hmm. only they're greatly expanded. Falston, for instance, was the main street and those few side streets. A couple of churches, Friends Meeting House. I came in contact with Quakers pretty much for the first time here. There were a few at college, but I really enjoyed knowing them. They seemed like such good people. The Youth Benefit Elementary School had something like 150 students. Now it's got about 1,000, something, or more. Used to be able to ride uptown from here to the courthouse in just a few minutes. You can still ride up there in just a few minutes, but you have 6 traffic lights between you and the courthouse now.
What were the roads like then?
The first time I ever came to my husband's home, this house would view. It was gravel from Route 1 down toll gate, down moving back to Dinya. Gravel. And dusty.
And what year was that?
It was 1945.
And then when did the road start to change?
Different times in different places. This one, I can't even remember when, but I think my husband told you in his interview about his mother talking to somebody who was running for office. Yeah, they suffered under those dusty roads. There was a milk stand on the corner of Route 1 and Tollgate Road. And the dairy farmers of the area took their milk up there every morning early and sat around and enjoyed each other's company, waiting for the big tank truck from Baltimore to come and pick it up. They exchanged news, you know. It was a great meeting every morning.
What was the milk stand? Was it a little structure?
It was wooden. It was about... maybe not 6 feet tall, but
4 feet,
something like that, perhaps. Wooden. And they just stacked their milk cans on it. They were all marked, of course, with the farmers' names on them.
You'd sit around their trucks and chat with one another?
Mm-hmm. Or get out of the truck. I enjoyed meeting all the agricultural element in the county, because I grew up in an agricultural county myself, even though I was a town girl. My husband's very proud to call himself a countryman. I actually grew up in a town, but surrounded by country.
Can you do a comparison for me of the early Harford County and Harford County now?
Well, the early Harford County, someone else would have to tell you who was here. Mm-hmm. My memory goes back only to 1947, and I have had fun telling some people who moved here really recently, within the last 5 years or something like that. And they asked me, was I a native? And I'd say, no, I'm a newcomer. I came in 1947. But from a historical point of view, that is a newcomer. And I, having grown up in a community that was very parochial, even though it was a college town, which expanded its horizons a good bit in one way, still, if you were born there, you know, it was different from being an outsider. You've had that, you know all about that. The interesting thing to me was how many things for the good of the area were accomplished by newcomers.
In Harford County?
Yes, and in our hometown too, so I couldn't be surprised. You know, when you stop and look around, who is it that is doing the League of Women Voters Hospice? The library. The hospital volunteers. Oh, you could go on and on and on, except for you almost always had natives doing things like the Farm Bureau and the, what's that other thing? But much of the community well-being, community improvement effort really was instigated and led by people who moved in from outside. They had known about it where they came from. I think when you live in a place all your life, you do tend to take it more, take it easier and more for granted. I'm not sure, but that could be true.
I know in Lexington, Virginia, where I grew up, and I felt, you know, this is my home. People coming in, and there were always people coming in from the outside in a college town like that, which was very good for it. There was always these newcomers who were starting the community theater and the art festivals, and, you know, all sorts of things. And I think that's true here too. So, just as long as it gets done, it doesn't really matter who does it. It's interesting though. One of the nicest comments about how to live happily in a new place, I heard a young woman say, I sat next to her at dinner very shortly after I moved here, and I asked her how she liked Harford County. I cannot quote her answer, but it involved a beautiful, positive statement about how much she was looking forward to meeting the people here, entering into the life of the community, having her children here. You know, it was not, oh gee, I really miss New Jersey, something awful. Her name is Mignon Cameron, and she married a man who later became Judge Broadnax Cameron. He was Broadnax Cameron all along. He became judge later. He was a lawyer when she married him. But I thought that was one lovely attitude about being a bride in a new area. Don't you?
Yes, I do. Is that the attitude you had too, or what was your feeling then?
Well, I think I admired her attitude because it reflected mine.
Mm-hmm. I suspected that too.
But I didn't say it as nicely as she did.
And so how did you become involved in the community in your early days here?
I grew up was a very strong example before me of my mother. No. She founded a children's clinic. She belonged to a book club. She did a lot. And, you know, I saw her doing these things. And I thought, that's great. That's great. It was the children's clinic she founded was a result of her having been at Johns Hopkins.
Hello? Yes? Would you take a message, please?
Go ahead. The children's clinic was founded where?
Lexington, Virginia, Rockbridge County, Virginia, by my mother. That was a result of her intense interest in child health, which she had gained at Johns Hopkins when she was in nursing school there. She carried that right on. Oh, let's see. She was interested in music, my mother was. So am I. She belonged to a book club. So do I, you know. I belong to FISH. Are you familiar with FISH?
I haven't heard of it.
It's a combination of the churches, mostly. There are a few people in it who are not. They're mostly church people. It's an emergency service, which was started in England back in the 20s. And now, in this county, there is a monthly schedule, and somebody is available on the phone every day in Aberdeen, Edgewood Joppa, and Bel-Air West Harper to receive requests for help in food, transportation, medicine, gas and electric bills, whatever is an emergency. I've been doing that because my mother inspired me. She really did. And that's been going for over 35 years in Harford County. And I've been in it since it was founded. And I enjoy a book club I belong to very much.
Was FISH founded in response to specific needs?
It was for emergency help. It was in an English village, I believe. And what they did then was to put a picture of a fish in the window. And then whoever saw it would come in and offer help.
What was the motivation for starting a chapter here in Harford County?
It was the good people of St. Margaret's Roman Catholic Church in Bel-Air. They are the ones who really got it started here.
And they saw a need for some sort of civilian assistance service?
Well, I wouldn't say civilian. I would say
non-government, private.
Right, that's it. They, I really admired their Christian commitment to service. And this was just one aspect of it. And once they got it started, others joined in. But it was, my hat is off to St. Margaret's Church people.
Tell me about the time 35 years ago when they saw this need. What were they responding to? What kind of specifics?
I don't know. I was not in on the first meeting. I just joined when asked, when I heard about it. One thing that bothered me, not many things bothered me, but one did. Having just come out of working with the Red Cross of wounded soldiers, very seriously wounded. When I got here, my mother-in-law, whose home this was, very kindly invited me to join the garden club she belonged to. And I went to a meeting of it to see. And at that meeting, the president read a letter that she had received from the director, one of the directors at the Perry Point Veterans Hospital. And the letter said, "We want to help our patients
who are able to do so, to have little gardens. We think it would be good therapy for them. They would be carefully screened because Prairie Point was a mental hospital. They would be screened. They would have an attendant with them. But what we need are people who know how to garden. So we are putting in a request to your garden club to provide us with members who can come over Tuesday and Friday afternoons from 2 to 4 or something and help our patients. We'll plow up the ground, we'll provide the seeds and the tools and the attendants. Oh, we just need your expertise in gardening. And this group of women voted no, because they were very apprehensive to be near mental patients. They did not have confidence that the hospital director would select only those patients who would not harm them. It was understandable, but it made me furious. Having just come from where I'd come from, I couldn't believe that they would turn that down.
So what was your response to them?
I did not join the garden club. I admired many of the accomplishments of the club in years since then. They've done beautiful things. And I have friends among the membership, certainly. But I just couldn't. And they never asked me again.
And maybe Prairie Point never got its gardens either.
I hope they did. I hope they did. I hope that director over there was persevering, and maybe he turned to the garden club of Cecil County, if there was one. It's a very, very tough life to be in charge of mental patients who are hospitalized permanently. Very tough. You can imagine, I'm sure. I can't, but I...
We know it's so. It's difficult. Do you remember anything else from your early time here of adjusting to your new role?
Missing the mountains, I said. I thought the roads were very bumpy and curvy, which proves that the state of Virginia had a good road system even in those days. They were very proud of their road system. And my mother, who was totally socially, social conscience oriented, rather than creature comforts oriented, used to speak scornfully of the state of Virginia for putting more money into roads than they did in hospitals and schools, which she thought was the limit.
Yeah, I can certainly sort of understand that. And you raised your children here in Harford County?
Right here in this house.
What was it like for those your children to grow up here? What were their school situations like?
The schools were fine. I was a great believer in public education, having been a product of that myself, and yet I had 2 or 3 years in a private school along the way before I graduated from high school. But every parent has to decide if that's your attitude, if you are a strong believer in public education, and you better be, because it educates, 98% of the children in the county. If you are a believer in it, then you've got to decide, are you going to put your children into it? Is it good enough for your children? You have to ask yourself. Are you going to sacrifice yourself on the altar of a principle? Every conscientious, educated parent needs to ask himself this question. And our children went for six, right straight through sixth grades here in Harford County. And then my husband felt so strongly that he wanted to give them the very best he could. He transported them to private schools in Baltimore, Gilman and Bryn Mawr. Year after year after year, he drove them in there, and then the mothers took turns bringing them home. And they certainly did learn to write well there. And they learned, had fine, basic schooling. They lost some things by going in there, which I think, because I'm prejudiced in favor of my children, I think they have compensated for pretty well. I said to him, if they start showing any signs of snobbishness, they are going to be taken out of those private schools so fast it's going to make their heads spin. And they didn't, so we didn't. But I was watching for it all the time. It was hard for them, though, to have their friends there, you know, this cut-up life.
So if you had one thing to say about your time in Harford County, what would it be? One overall. My name is Natalie Peters, and I'm here on June 16, 1994, with Rosa Crocker and Michael Crocker. And we are here to talk about Harford County history. I just want to start anywhere. Why don't we just go ahead and combine it, anything that either of you all would like to say, and we'll get a jump on things.
What's the purpose of this? I don't understand what's going on.
Well, let me stop this. Can you start right there with when you were a child, you say that nobody would go to Haverty Grace?
No, I didn't say that.
Oh, I'm sorry. What did you say?
It was a river town.
Right.
I mean, think about it. It is a river town. And river towns notoriously are low-grade places.
Mm-hmm.
It's suddenly gotten very pure. And it had a racetrack. And in the olden times, people didn't gamble. That was what, you know, that was considered very low grade behavior. What's wrong?
Hold on, sorry. So tell me about the racetrack and what.
Well, racetracks are, in the olden days, were not viewed as desirable parts of a community. They are now, because everybody's on the gambling jag these days. But it wasn't so in times past. You know, take Hialeah. I mean, think of the racetracks. I mean, over there around Pimlico. You know, that's a pretty rough crowd that shows up there. You know, she went to the Kentucky Derby. Because she lived for a while with her uncle and aunt who were in Lexington, Kentucky. And she stowed away in the back of a car, am I not correct? So she could get in to the, what's the one that goes on there, Bill? What's the first one of the races? Churchill Downs, isn't it? Yeah, and that's a little. And they had to take her in. It was against the law. She got in the back of the uncle's car and went from Lexington, Kentucky, down to Louisville, and they had to take her in. How old were you then?
In the third grade.
You were in the third grade. Can you tell me? Do you remember? You must remember the what motivated you to do that.
I didn't want to be left out. There were no other children in the household. I was visiting my aunt and her husband, and everybody had been talking about the Derby for a long time. It was a big deal in Kentucky, And I certainly didn't want to be left out. They showed no signs of being interested in taking me, so I just got in the trunk of the car.
It was against the law?
I didn't know that at the time. Of course I wouldn't have gone if I'd realized it was against the law.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
But we should get back to Harford County and your memories of how the place is different now, and say some positive things at least, because I know that most of your reaction is negative. But say some positive things.
What do you want me to say?
How did your family come to Harford County?
My family's been here since 1790. Do you know the big house down on, as you go around the Beltway, called Hampton Mansion?
Yes.
Well, the Ridgelys, was a wife there, and my great-grandmother was her sister. And this house, which was built in 1744, was built by slaves. And so it was, the Ridgelys had 392 slaves. I mean, nobody can build a house like this. I mean, this is all streamstone. This is not niggerhead rock, because that's what occurs on the surface. And the streamstone is much prettier. Niggerhead rock has hematite in it, and that's what rouge is made of. And there's a niggerhead rock right up in Bel Air. It's a much less attractive
stone. Building stone.
And hematite is a native ore of iron, and that's what rouge is made out of when a woman puts it on her face.
But this kind of construction in this material was very common in the time when this house was built. It's rare and wonderful now, but when it was built, there were many houses built.
Not of streamstone.
Oh, really?
Oh, no. This came out of way down and was brought here, and I'm sure that was because the two sisters, one Ridgely and one ultimately Pugh. And Pugh is a French Huguenot name, not P-U-G-H, that's Roman Catholic. And this road here, called Somerville Road, used to be called the New Cut Road through the old Pugh place. And because Maryland is the free state, it's the first of the 13 states that had freedom of religion. That's the reason you've got the oldest Jewish community in Maryland is in Baltimore, and why you have Charles Carroll, Lord Baltimore, was a Roman Catholic. And so they came initially to Maryland, and that's where the name Free State comes from. I don't know, I'd have to sit down and prepare a lecture. Have you ever read History of Maryland?
Yeah, I've
It's a wonderful book about that day. It has a very old history.
So did your family come here for the religious freedom too?
Or? No. My people, the Pughs came first. They left upon the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, when the Roman Catholics were killing all the Protestants in France. And Huguenots went all over the world. They went to South Carolina. They went to South Africa. Mm-hmm. They went here, and my people published the first Irish newspaper, not P-U-G-H, mm-hmm. but P-U-E, Pugh's Appearances. I've got a copy of that stage.
So they came from France to Ireland, to Maryland?
No, they went to Wales. They went to Ireland, and that was the Pugh's Appearances was the first Irish newspaper. And from there they went to Howard County, Maryland, and they came up here after Dr. Michael Pugh, who had come from Dublin. I guess they must have gone to Baltimore County up here, 1790, answer your question.
One of his ancestors was a medical doctor who served in the Whitefoot area, the miners, the Welch miners.
They gave, the Pews gave 690 acres in the northern part of this county, Dr. Michael Pew. And he was married.
Gave it to whom?
Gave it for the church.
Oh, okay.
Just up across, just, you know, we went up there to church, just across,
yes,
before you crossed
the You said they gave it, but you didn't say what did they give it for.
For the Presbyterian church up there.
Okay.
And how many acres is was this parcel originally?
Well, this parcel was originally 643 acres, and another Pew, who married a canard, owned Constant Friendship, that where all his apartments are, as you go on down 24. That goes right through Constant Friendship. And those roads down, the old Emerton Road was, you went down, you know where Boyle Buick is? That's the old Emerton Road, and St. Mary's Church, the Protestant Episcopal Church, and the Pews established that church. My great-grandfather was the first person baptized or confirmed, I forget which one it was, and he was Michael Edward Pew.
They're all buried down there, and we've got a lot there too. It holds 8 caskets or 24 incineration urns, cremation urns. So just think how much more efficient it is to be cremated.
But I don't know it's desirable because they exhumed people. Look, they exhumed who was the president they thought had been poisoned. And they all exhumed him.
I don't expect that problem.
Zachary Taylor. Just
that's true.
Just 3 years ago. And they found that they thought he'd been poisoned.
Getting back to your early family here, you were born in this house, is that right?
No, I was born in Bel Air. My mother was born in the same room in which she died, 82 years apart.
In this house.
And there's, this is the really the Pew family. It's not the Crocker family.
Mm-hmm.
The Crockers, they were on the wrong side of the American Civil War. And my grandmother Crocker, to the great ire of the Maryland citizens, used to take hot soup down to the federal troops on Federal Hill. And of course, the Maryland was essentially a southern state. My grandfather commanded Company K of the 1st Virginia Cavalry under Jeb Stuart. I remember grandmother very well. She was Jefferson Davis's goddaughter. And Jefferson Davis used to come here and visit grandmother and grandfather. The grandfather, they were 20 years apart. He ran a store down at Rectortown, Virginia, which is down below Washington in Fauquier County, I guess. Yes, it's Fauquier County. Didn't come home for 7 years.
Tell me what you remember about your grandparents.
I never knew grandfather because his favorite horse kicked him.
I'll introduce you to them by picture.
Yeah. Grandmother I remember very well. She used to tell me about the 7 days fight around Richmond. And she'd tell me about, because I was 17 when she died.
What do you...
She lived here.
Uh-huh. That's marvelous. So your grandfather was killed by his horse, is that right?
No.
No.
He was kicked by his favorite horse and broke all the ribs on one side of his body, and it took him 2 years to die. He died in 1904. But he was already 20 years older than grandmother, because she was born in New Orleans and she was age...
17?
No.
When she was married?
She was age 4 when grandfather was born, because there was a 20-year difference.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these are your father's parents or your mother's?
No,
your mother's
parents. They're mother's parents.
That's his mother up there, and mother and father mm-hmm. as a young couple beside him.
Mm-hmm. I'm not an expert speaker, but I ought to be. I'm a trial lawyer. I appeared in court for a long, long period of time.
Which means lots of preparation.
That's mm-hmm. right. Mm-hmm. What else do you want to ask me?
Well, I'd love to hear your family stories about your grandparents. Do you remember about the
seven? I remember grandmother very well. Mm-hmm. And of course, I remember my mother, my aunt, and my two aunts. And the man for whom I'm named when my grandmother's father was Ballard S. Dunn, and he was a colonel in the Southern Army. He was a chaplain, ostensibly, but he was called the Evergreen of the Confederacy. And he had, we've got a copy of it, a bill of exchange worth $50,000, and he used to go to England to try to buy guns for the Confederacy. And he was an unreconstructed rebel. And he took 3,000 Southerners to Brazil. And we have a little silver elephant. And when Grandmother Pugh, the lady I'm talking about, when Grandfather went down there, and Dom Pedro II, who was the Portuguese emperor of Brazil, and she used to play with it as a little child while Grandfather Dunn was negotiating, and he got a piece of land down there.
Tell why he went.
Because he was an unreconstructed rebel.
They couldn't bear to stay here with the war over, having lost.
Oh, yeah. They didn't want any part of the Yankees. You know, that was a very real thing, that Mason-Dixon line, and you can tell that. You cross that Mason-Dixon line, we have a good friend who is a landscape architect.
You know him.
A restoration, Jim Wallen. He said, I can get business from Maryland to South Carolina, but can I cross that Mason-Dixon line? People say the American Civil War, it's been over a long, long time ago. Well, I remember grandmother very, very well. And she's telling me about the 7 days fight around Richmond.
What do you recall about that?
Pardon?
What do you recall about her story about the 7 days?
Well, I remember her telling me, of course, I've read a lot of history. I was both a geology major and a history major, and history fascinates me. And she said that during that fight, Grandfather, who, as I say, was 20 years older than she was, had a tarpaulin over it, and that was a terrible battle that went on. It was the one just north of Richmond, and Grant was gradually closing in on Richmond. Grandfather had a tarpaulin over it, and somebody in the middle of the night got in behind him, and it was Jeb Stuart. And Jeb Stuart was killed at Yellow Tavern, and he was killed on Grandfather's watch, so to speak, Company K.
Company K, 1st Virginia Cavalry.
That's right, 1st Virginia Cavalry, which was probably the most famous Southern horse group. That was the one when Lee kept saying, "Where is Stuart? Where is Stuart?" Because the only way he knew, he didn't know where Meade was, and they didn't know where, they didn't have barrage balloons and all that sort of thing, you see. It was the first great war, the last great war of movement, and all the German generals came here and studied the American Civil War, Rommel and all of them.
Did you know that?
Because they, you know, all you had to do was to use tanks instead of horses and airplanes, and it just sped up everything. Do you think of anything else? I'm garrulous. I can go on and on and on, but it's not organized.
well, we don't need so much organization. This is terrific. This is exactly what I want to hear about. And when we get to the point where you move into the story, just come on in, because I would like to start back as far back as you can remember the stories your grandparents.
Well, I remember I was 15 years old when this house was refurbished. And I remember Mother went with Daddy over to Rock Creek Park.
Was that 1933?
Well, I was born in 1918. That's the difference. Is that what it comes to? That's
1933.
And I remember, I wish I had gone along with it, because they've got St. Gaudens Statue of Grief over there. And that's where Lincoln used to spend his vacations. That's the most beautiful. That was Riggs' summer home. And he gave it, Riggs National Bank, and he gave it to Washington, to the city of Washington. And the president used to spend his vacations there.
Gave it for a cemetery?
No.
For a park?
No, that's the old soldier's home.
Oh, okay.
And grandfather, Uncle Arthur. Now, Uncle Arthur changed his name from Arthur Pugh to Arthur Bull, his mother's maiden name, because that's where he ultimately ended up his last days. And he fought the Indian wars under General Sherman in the West, and he got to spend his last days because of the Indian wars. And he fought them under Sherman after the American Civil War was done, and I wish I had met him, because I was...
You've read what he's written, though.
Oh, yeah. I've got a book on him. And as a matter of fact, you said you're Lexington, Virginia?
Richmond.
Mm-hmm. Pardon?
Family's from Richmond.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I thought you said Lexington.
My grandmother's living there now.
I see. Uh-huh. Because... your mother said that the doctor, Uncle Arthur, he was Arthur Pugh, and he ran away. He weighed about 170 pounds. He was 17 years old, and he got on a horse and he crossed and went down here. Do you know that historical marker down there on Old Joppa Road and Mountain Road?
Gilmore's raid.
Yeah, Harry Gilmore. That's Gilmore Street, Baltimore. He was a major, and he rode all the way around the Northern Army, and they
outflanked him.
Yeah, and he understood that they were coming around here, and he got on his horse and another guy, and at 17 years old.
You're speaking of your grandfather now.
No, I'm speaking of my great uncle.
Oh, okay.
Uncle Arthur. And he was died in 1915. When I was 15 years old. And Mother and Daddy said, if you can drive this truck, and I remember...
Said to you?
To me, if you can drive this truck, and I would just clean out everything that's down here in the cellar, because the cellar is only from that hallway to here. All the rest is a crawl space. The house was built in three parts. Well, I was much more interested in driving a truck at 15, because, you know, I was...
Than
going, but I wish I had gone over to Rock Creek Park, which is a beautiful place.
You could have met Uncle Arthur.
Well, I don't know. No, that was his funeral.
Oh, okay.
But I wish they'd taken me there earlier.
So Arthur Pugh got on his horse when the army was coming, and
when Harry Gilmore rode all the way around the Southern Army. Jubal Early. Mm-hmm. It wasn't Jubal Early. Who was it?
Where did he go, Arthur Pugh?
He went on across. He crossed at White's Ferry. Do you know where White's Ferry is? He crossed at White's Ferry, and he fought for about 45 days in the battle of what was the northernmost battle?
Gettysburg.
Of the Shenandoah Valley.
Oh.
North of Winchester.
Antietam?
No. Antietam's in Maryland. I'm trying to think of the great cavalry leader from the north.
Bull's Run?
Hmm?
Is that Bull's Run?
No, Bull's Run, there were two Bull's Runs. Mm-hmm.
Bull Run.
Bull Run, right.
Yeah, Bull Run. No, I'm trying to think. He was
Sherman?
No, Brent Grant was from the Midwest.
Sherman, I said. Is he the one you're talking about?
No, I'm trying to think of the name of the guy. He came from New Jersey. He was a great cavalry leader, and they had a long series of battles.
And your Uncle Arthur fought against this man.
That's right. He was captured.
Your uncle was captured?
Oh, yeah.
God, then what
And
happened?
He was put in a prison camp.
Where?
In Ohio, I think. And he escaped from there. And he
Good
was recaptured, and they put him in a prison camp near Richmond. And he escaped there, and he made his way up the James River. And he got to Lexington, and your mother knew the old doctor who had taken care of grandpa, of great uncle.
Amazing.
Yeah, because your mother lived to be 94.
Just for the purpose of the tape, that's Rosa Crocker's mother who
That's right.
knew that. Yep.
She was Rosa, she was Laura Powell Tucker. She married Fletcher.
Mm-hmm.
And she was Lewis Powell's cousin.
But you are talking about your Uncle Arthur, who was in the Civil War. Your own grandfather was in the Civil War, too.
I understand.
Both of them, and they were brothers.
But Uncle Arthur was younger than grandfather.
Uh-huh.
He's the older. He was Edward Hill Dorsey Pugh, you see.
Your grandfather's name.
That's right. And so you have so many Virginia cities in the West, because the Southerners, after the American Civil War, went west, and you have Virginia cities in Montana and in Wyoming and so on down the line, and all the bars were segregated up until the time of the great
Civil Rights Movement.
Civil Rights Movement, exactly so, because of that fact. And he and I have his biography. It came here.
Whose biography?
Uncle Arthur's biography. It was called the Memoirs of a Rolling Stone or something like that. And our daughter lives in Lander, Wyoming now. And Uncle Arthur worked first, he never married, and he worked first for the first superintendent of the Yellowstone Park, which is the first national park in America. And he badly injured his right arm, and he cut wood out there for the superintendent. I forget who it was, whether it was Powell, you know, the guy that went on down the river. I think he was the first superintendent, because that's 1870.
Did he come back to Harford County before he went into the old soldiers' home in Washington?
He sure did. He sure did. He came back here 30 years later, and grandmother and my great aunt was Aunt Lily. She was Mary Elizabeth Pugh, and she was married twice.
Married the second time to a Harford County personage?
Yeah, but he was no blood relative of mine.
But just the same, she was married to him, and he was a Harford County personage. What's his name?
Preston.
Judge Walter Preston.
And the Preston Gardens. Do you know the Preston Gardens in Baltimore? His brother was seven times the mayor of Baltimore, and Uncle Walter was here, and Uncle Walter's buried right down in St. Mary's Churchyard.
But your Uncle Arthur's return to me is a very dramatic story.
Oh, yeah. And he showed up at Aunt Lily's home. She was married first to Thomas White Hall, and the Halls owned 1,000 acres, which is down there now where all his apartments are. Constant Friendship. And she showed up.
He showed up.
And he said to his sister, Mary Elizabeth Pugh, whom we called Aunt Lily, and I remember her very well.
Mrs. Walter Preston.
Yeah. She said, come on in here, Arthur. She hadn't seen him in 30 years, and he had roamed the West. And he's the guy who died when I was 15 years old in the old soldier's home. And what he did was, of course, he he fought for the Indian Wars, and that therefore gave him the right to be put up free of charge.
What sort of reunion was it? Were they glad to see him when she said, come on in here?
Well, of course she was. And two of my uncles, my great uncles, are buried. One was a mining superintendent, and I meant to go and look his place. He was a mining superintendent in Montana. Helena.
In Helena, Montana. What brought Arthur back?
I always wanted to come home. You know?
He lived a hard life.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good life, it was a free life, but it was a very hard working. That's the story.
So interested because we have a daughter.
No family, except here.
We have a daughter who lives in Wyoming, and they're in the Wind River Valley, and there are hot springs there. Mm-hmm. And he said it was the most beautiful valley he ever was in, and they used to have hot baths out there in Wyoming in those days, you see. And Bethany knows where they are. We've done a lot of back riding and so on out in the West. And Bethany's done, this is our daughter who's a lawyer in Wyoming. She's the girl up there, right there. She's this one right here.
So when Arthur came back, he lived here with your sister? With his sister, did he move
I
in?
Don't know.
First of all, his sister did not live here.
No, yeah. She didn't, I see.
This was the Pew homestead.
Mm-hmm.
And she was Mary Elizabeth Pew, who married Thomas White Hall.
Right.
And then he died, and she married Walter W. Preston.
Mm-hmm.
And he's buried right down here in St. Mary's Church.
What kind of judge was he?
Well, he was
judge of
pompous as hell.
No, judge of what?
Of the U.S. The county court. He was the only court.
Circuit court.
Circuit court for Harford County. Okay.
Aunt Lily was a match for him, though.
Oh, was she ever? She was a good artist. And he was
a painter?
A painter. And he was the law in Harford County.
He was the what?
The law.
L-A-W.
L-A-W.
And he knew it.
And he knew it. And she, he hid her. You know, they were two very willful people, and he hid some of her painting gear, and he had on each side, and I remember that very distinctly, he had a complete history of all of the reports that had ever been issued in Maryland.
Law books.
Law books. Mm-hmm. And that's very valuable to have those, because they go way, way back, way, way back. And he wouldn't tell her where her painting gear was. So she went over, and they were on both sides of the fireplace, and she went over and she picked out one, and she threw it into the fireplace, and he damn near exploded. And she said, Walter, when you produce my painting gear, whatever she called it, I'll stop throwing these books in the fire. She knew how to handle them. She was a wonderful guy. I remember her very distinctly. Got a picture of her.
It's interesting that she would have been a painter and that your father, who was not kin to her but an in-law, married your mother,
mm-hmm.
was also an artist.
Yes, daddy was an artist, yeah. He was a very good artist.
Graduate of the Maryland Academy.
Maryland
Institute.
Arts, which is one of the best art schools in America. Of the 10 best. That's right. He's had, I can't get his record because it's been burned three times. It was burned once when it was down, used to be down at the Fish Market. Do you know where the Fish Market is in Baltimore? That used to be the Maryland Institute for the Arts.
And then it came up, and it was right alongside of it. Do you know where the old Stanley Theater is? On Howard Street.
I know Howard Street.
Yeah, well, it was a beautiful theater there called the Stanley Theater. I remember as a child, then up out of the bowels of the earth came a pipe organ. I mean, it would, you know, I dwelt marble halls, you know. I can remember going down there. And, you know, it's all so changed in Hartford. You know, Baltimore was the metropolis of the South. You went from Baltimore to New Orleans. And Baltimore is so drastically changed. It was the northernmost southern city. You go down there and look at Mount Vernon Place. And that's the first monument to Washington, mm-hmm. right down there. And
that's where your father came from, Baltimore.
That's right. Because, you know where Loyola College is? Mm-hmm. Well, the Crockers owned right opposite Loyola College. They had 16 acres there. Think about that. Got a whole lot of apartments down there. And I always wished Loyola College had bought it. I used to track rabbits down there. On that 16 acres of land.
About what year was that?
Well, we moved into Baltimore. Henry Ford broke my father. And the way that happened was, Daddy was the first Ford dealer here in the county.
And there's still people who remember him in that capacity.
And he used to buy Model T Fords $500, and Henry Ford, who was a terrible man, he was absolutely ruthless. He cut the cost of the plane of the Model T Ford from $500, and Daddy had to buy those outright. He cut him to $300, and it bankrupted Daddy in 1927. And then along came the Great Depression in 29, and my father was an artist, and he couldn't make a living. Those were tough times. I remember when I was a kid picking
ferns
for 25 cents a hundred and sell them to a Jewish florist in Baltimore. It's right on the corner of Charles and Reed Street.
What year was that? That was during the Depression?
Well, yeah, that was during the Depression. Let me see. We moved here because Daddy went bankrupt. And my own uncle, his oldest brother, lent him $6,000. $6,000 in those days.
To live on or what?
That's right.
To live on.
That's right. And we moved into Baltimore, and he said, Sam, the oldest brother, he said, you just take that place. Well, Uncle Sam didn't take the place.
This place.
That's right. What he did was to rent it out. And then we had an extraordinary thing happen. The largest estate in the United States was $130 million of a woman named Ella Wendell. And her father had been John Checkmaster's fur trading partner. And when she died, she was undue influence was practiced upon her by a man named Cuss. And a suit was brought challenging the will. And when Ella died, she left 125 pieces of land on the island of Manhattan, right in the middle of the Depression. And they traced it back, and the common ancestor was Brigadier General Tobias Stansberry, and my mother's middle name was Bethenia Stansberry Pugh, and she married Henry True Crocker. And that's her picture, and mm-hmm. Mother didn't die until she was 82, and she lived here, and my wife took care of her. She died in the same room where she was born, 82 years apart. And I remember I used to go with her down to Sparrows Point. We were related to the Sparrows, and Stansberry Manor They owned all that land where the marketing company is, but they never figured out how to get clear title.
So what happened with the distribution of the land on Manhattan?
I don't know what happened, because the Stansberry's a very prominent family. If you look at the history of Maryland, you'll find that he commanded the Battle of Bladensburg, and that's the War of 1812 when the British burned Washington. That is the second American Revolution, in effect. And if they fell back, and it was Sam Smith who really saved on the second American Revolution, and that's when Francis Scott Key wrote The Bombs Bursting in Air. And I went up to see Key's place, because we've got this daughter who lives down at Flint Hill, Virginia. It's much prettier way. And if you go up to Tawnytown and turn left and you head on towards Frederick, and then you go on down through Frederick and on down to Harper's Ferry. We always go that way to see our youngest daughter. This is the girl here on the left. And Francis Scott Key owned 2,000 acres. He was a young lawyer. He owned 2,000 acres up there.
Which was not quite as much in those days as it would be now, but still a large holding.
Oh, if you owned 2,000 acres. You owned 2,000 acres, that was damn near like the whole of Frederick County. Frederick County was one of the richest counties in America, agriculture.
So what was the astounding thing that happened to your family at the Depression, you were saying that?
Oh, as I say, we lived with my grandmother Crocker. And right next door to her lived Hugh Hampton Young. Have you ever heard of the Brady Clinic? Do you know who Diamond Jim Brady was? Mm-hmm. Who was he?
Well, I've heard of him.
Well, he had syphilis. And Hugh Hampton Young cured him of syphilis, because Dr. Hugh Hampton Young was from Texas. And I remember next door lives Hugh Hampton Young, and here was grandmother, who wore all dresses that went all the way down here. She had six boys, and she had a little bit of lace that went around her collar. That's the only way I ever remember grandmother.
Would you say that she was dressed in mourning for her husband's
death?
Oh,
she was in dress for mourning for her husband. She
for the rest of her
any
life?
Any other kind of clothes.
For the rest of her life?
For the rest of her life. And she was just as gentle. And she was a Methodist. And Methodists wouldn't have anything. Her own brother married a Roman Catholic, a rich woman from up in, and she disowned up for mourning. You know, because this is it's not very long ago, in a sense.
But you haven't come to Ella Wendell yet.
I've got the whole history of the Wendell estate upstairs. And so they were trying to figure out the relationship, because this was a maiden lady, Ella Wendell. There was one brother and one woman who had married, and there were three maiden sisters. And the motto of the Wendells was, buy and never sell.
Land?
So, in New York.
And they owned 125 pieces of real estate in the city of New York. And they tried to figure out the relationship. And there was a genealogist from Philadelphia.
You mean after Ella Wendell died?
After she died.
And when do you think she died?
I have to stop and think a moment. I was 14 years old.
1932,
because that's when we bought this place back.
And you bought it back because of Ella Wendell?
That's correct. That's right. Because of mother. And the arrangement, Samuel Undermeyer, Hayes Undermeyer, and so on, were one of the big strike law firms in New York, and they took it on a contingent basis. And the nearest relative was Rosa Dew Stansberry in Biloxi, Mississippi, I think it was. And that was part of the Stansberry family. And they simply made a deal with her that They would pay all the expenses and do all the various other things and take care of her. And then 60 other people were stood in. She was in the fifth degree relationship. You know how you measure degrees of relationship. You count from the dead person up to the common ancestor now. And she was one, she was an old, old lady. And grandmother stood in the sixth degree relationship. And there was ultimately a settlement worked out. And my grandmother and my mother, they had extraordinary memories. And so did a lot of the other old people around. I remember there were three old ladies down around Sparrows Point. And they knew that, let me see, who it was who changed his name and was, and they knew that because he had an uncle who said, if you will change your name to mine, I will leave my estate to you. And he lived over in Chestertown. And those ladies had remembered Clara Rohan. And they lived down in the Middle River area, which were a lot of very old families lived down there. There were three old ladies. And I have all their names upstairs. And I used to go around with Mother when I was 14 years old. And she worked all this out, and a genealogist came down from Philly.
She did field work research.
She did, and between...
Trying to establish relationship.
Yeah.
My mother did that. Trying to establish relationship to the maiden lady who left.
Well, they wanted to know. The only way they knew, Mother's name, maiden, my name, was Berthenia Stansberry Pugh. And the relationships all went through General Tobias Stansberry, who commanded the Battle of Bladensburg. It fell back to where they were overwhelmed by the British.
And that was your grandfather.
That was my great grandfather. That was my great, because he was about, well, the Battle of Bladensburg, 1812, was Fort McHenry. And they fell back, you remember, and you had the British were here bombarding Fort McHenry, and Francis Scott Key, the young lawyer, was aboard a ship, and he saw the bombs bursting in air. He was saying, and so on. If you know that history, that's the way it goes, and really Sam Smith, who was a great general, he was the mayor of Baltimore, and he was the one that saved the Battle of Long Island under Washington. He was a real McCoy. And that's when, Ross, who was the commander, the British commander on Rossville. If you go down and look where, what's the big hospital in Eastern, around Baltimore? It's a great big hospital down there. There's Rossville Boulevard. And so on. And that's Ross. And he was killed by Wells and McComas. And Wells and McComas, one of them lived next door to Grandmother Crocker's people, who lived in Old Town Baltimore. Now this is not the Pews, this is the Crockers. And of course these guys were English. And he said, bring me a raincoat. And Wells, I guess it was, or McComas, of course they were, you know, we were talking about Englishmen. Revolutionary Englishmen is what it came to. And Wells or McComas, I guess they were sharpshooters, and they killed General Ross. And with that, they all got back aboard their ships and sailed out of the Chesapeake Bay and never saw them again. Well, you got any other ideas?
Let me trace this story back if I can. Well, what happened was your father had these financial difficulties because of Henry IV raising the price of the cars.
That's right.
And how this estate was lost during that time, is that
my
right?
My father bought it when he used to pitch against Babe Ruth.
Your father did?
No, my father pitched against Babe Ruth because Babe was a foundling at St. Mary's Industrial School. Uh-huh. And he was a pitcher, you see, and Daddy pitched for the Lyondale Club, and Babe was a foundling, but Babe knew he knew what was on that ball. Not only was he a great hitter, but he knew what was on the ball, and he was a left-hander at that. And he, you know, when Babe pointed out there, he knew what was coming across that plate. And I've often wanted to go down and get out the old Ballmer Sons and so on to see, because Daddy was an excellent athlete. He could skate. He could do all
ice skate.
Ice skate. He could do. He was one of the organizers of the Ballmer Ice Club.
And how did the house, this house, your mother's house, right?
Yeah.
Your mother's family's house. How did this, your family come to lose this house?
My father bought it.
From?
I'm trying to think. Because when we bought this house, and the house was deeded us, it was deeded by Bethenia Pugh Crocker, Elizabeth Pugh Williams, and Clara Pugh Graham to you and me. And I don't know precisely, I've never gone, we've had the title searched, but I don't know whether what happened in that period of time, because the Stansburys are all buried right up on the hill up here. And I don't know when grandfather's horse killed him, and then Uncle Michael Pugh took his widowed mother and three sisters and went to Pocahontas County, West Virginia, which is just west of where Hot Springs is now. And he was either murdered or a horse shied, and he never regained consciousness. He was only 32 years old.
Who was that?
The man for whom I'm named. He was Michael Edward Pugh.
And he was your...
He was my mother's brother. And I knew both his older sister, Clara Pugh, and I knew Elizabeth Pugh Williams very well. And I knew Bethenia Pugh, Stansbury Pugh, who died in this house. Mm-hmm. And I knew Clara Pugh, Cornelia Calmes Dunn Pugh from New Orleans, who lived up here and died when I was 17 years old.
So your mother's brother took the family to West Virginia, and how did they come back?
They came back here because they used to come up. I know my father, when he was courting my mother, he went out with Uncle Michael, from the man for whom I'm named, and they drove up stream beds and did all sorts of things. Since that was the beginning of all automobiles in those days. And he used to talk about going out there to see Uncle, and Uncle Michael was killed when he is 32 years old.
And how much older is he than your parents, your father and your mother?
Well, let's see, mother died at 82, and if he hadn't been killed, he might very, because I knew my mother's two sisters, and of course I knew my mother, mm-hmm. and I would have known my uncle if he hadn't died prematurely. So mm-hmm. we had two things happen in our family. One was, just like her grandmother, they didn't know whether to operate on. There were six surgeons deciding whether.
That's a diversion.
No, but it's the great
it's the era.
The great advances that have occurred in medicine.
We'll get it all in. Diversions are fine as long as we come back around. So you're saying there are two things that happened to your family, and they were
on the Pugh side. Mm-hmm. Grandfather was in the American Civil War. He ran a store at Record Town, Virginia, which is in Fauquier County, and he didn't come home for 7 years.
Because
Jefferson Davis was in irons down at Fortress and Monroe.
In prison.
At 10-2.
He thought it might not be safe.
Well, that's right. That's exactly so. And that's why Uncle Arthur changed his name from Arthur Pugh to Arthur Bull, his mother's maiden name, and went west and fought under Sherman the Indian Wars.
Was he trying to distance himself? I mean, as I say, was he concerned about keeping the Pugh name because of the...
Oh, sure, he was on.
Because
that was the bloodiest war Americans have ever fought.
And they were presumably looking for the Pughs, is that right, or were the...
Well, he didn't. He was an escaped. He was an escaped prisoner. You know, I mean, think about old Stanton. Think about what went on in the American Civil War. I mean, that Stanton was a terrible man. And you think what they did to who was the president who was impeached but avoided conviction by one vote? He was an outstanding guy. You know who I mean? Right up front of the American Civil War. Andrew Johnson. Ask me more questions.
Well, you were saying there were two things that happened in the family after your mother's brother took the family
to West Virginia, right. And he was only 32 years old.
Right.
And he was a very successful guy.
We were going to figure out how much older he was than your mother. Do you recall?
Mother was the youngest. It went Aunt Clara, Uncle Michael, Aunt Liz, and Mother. Mother was the youngest.
She was born in 1893.
Okay.
Mother. That's right. I remember Aunt Clara was, I was 3 years old when Aunt Clara was married right here.
And then you're not really sure on the details of how the house changed hands and then came back in here?
Well, that's what I don't know because there was some murder that went on. And this guy, Preston, I always thought he used to be the president of the Commercial Savings Bank, which is now the Bank of Virginia. Mm-hmm. It was one of the first banks around here, and I always thought he cheated my grandmother.
And this was this Judge Preston?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. How did he cheat your grandmother?
I think he took advantage of her.
Mm-hmm.
That's all over.
But still, the most important thing is that your mother finally succeeded in establishing a blood relationship to Ella Wendell.
That's right.
And your grandmother got how much?
$100,000 and $100,000
in windfall.
In the Depression was an enormous amount of money.
And with that, they bought the house back.
They bought this house back.
From whom? Who had the house during the Depression?
My Uncle Sam.
I see.
And he lent Daddy $6,000, which is a whole lot of money in those days, mm-hmm. and so on. And my father said, well, Sam, you just take the place. And Uncle Sam didn't take the place, he just rented it out. And when it got around to the point where my grandmother Q and her daughter, who was married to Sam's younger brother, got the money, then they just came up here and bought the place back.
Now, how much did they buy it back for, do you know?
No, but that'll all be on record.
Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to know what it sold for.
Well, probably a very modest amount, maybe exactly what he lent him.
Well, think about this.
I mean, he did it for the good of the family, not to make money. Isn't that true?
No.
Yeah.
He was the largest. The Crocker, Samuel Griffith Crocker, Jr., was the largest bee raiser in Maryland. He had 36 apiaries. He had two in this county, stretched all over. Do you know?
Stretched what?
Stretched all over Maryland. And I used to spin the keepers in a centrifugator, and he could hold up a jar of honey and say, that's clover and that's maple and so on down the line. He knew them just right off. And do you know, what's the great big florist shop there in Tassie? Beautiful florist shop. He and Ethan Allen Andrews.
Is it Griner?
Huh?
Griner?
No, it's not Griner. It starts with an A.
Oh.
You know, you've been in there.
It will come to you.
Yeah.
There's a big
they were, and it was very interesting who were the bee fanciers. Ethan Allen Andrews' father was a professor of engineering at Hopkins. Old Sam was the biggest bee raiser. And the man I'm talking about has got the best florist shop in the whole of Baltimore. And when you go across
was it Taylor Avenue, I think, and you're coming right down to where the Towson State is. And just about four blocks before you get to the York Road there, there's a great big florist shop. I mean, they grow it. So you want, it's the best flowers in, you can get in this 4 miles
away. And your relationship to the florist shop was?
My Uncle Sam.
Yes.
And this man were bee raisers. It's a very interesting thing what caused these people to, you know, they were all, how shall I say it?
Salt of the earth, solid citizens.
And they were going to damn well do what they wanted to do.
Nobody
was going to tell them what to do.
And so you remember your Uncle Sam?
Oh, very, very, very well. Yeah, I remember all my uncles very well. But the Crockers are a different of people. They're total English. And they came directly from England right here. And I had three uncles. My grandfather was Samuel Griffith Crocker. And he had four sisters. And three of them were old maids. And one was a good artist. And one used to go around and collect the ground rents around Baltimore. And one used to correspond. And I have her letters with all the vicars, it seemed to me, of England, trying to establish the Crocker relationship. And they come from Devon, England. It's a family name that goes way, way. You go. You know, we all are descended from the Seminade 4.5 million years ago. But it's always interested me. It interested my mother and my sister and so on.
His sister is a professional genealogist.
She is. What is her name?
Berthenia. Pugh. Crocker. Smith.
And that's your sister?
My sister. Uh-huh. And she lives down in Macon, Georgia. And she married, you know, the woman who wrote Gone with the Wind? Mm-hmm. That was his Smith's cousin.
It was whose cousin? Her husband's cousin.
Her husband, and
Margaret Mitchell.
Margaret Mitchell. And he used to go up to Tara. There were three old aunts. He just hated it. And Margaret Mitchell simply romanticized it, you see. Mm-hmm. So that's Gone with the Wind.
And literally.
Huh? Right.
The life is gone with the wind, too.
Yeah, as a matter of fact. This lady might be just that doesn't have a damn thing to do, except that I have a lot to do. This man. That's a good friend of my wife's family.
Mm-hmm. Pierre Dora?
Pierre Dora. And he had a name about this long.
Mm-hmm. Spanish nobleman. Simplified the name. Because he was that kind of person.
Mm-hmm. Your family history that you can remember, the stories, the tell me about your relatives that you remember growing up in this area.
Well, I remember.
Wait, this is the second. She'll have the tape in.
What?
No, the tape's in.
Oh,
this is the other.
Excuse me.
So start anytime.
The Pews are the ones that I remember best.
Mm-hmm.
And they were essentially Southerners.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember grandmother, and although I never knew Jefferson Davis, he used to come here after the American Civil War, mm-hmm. because his three sons were educated down in St. Mary's Church. Because he was the first preacher, first rector of St. Mary's Church, was from New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And he was called Uncle Willie Brand. And mother used to say, I had to go down there as a little girl because he would preach our sermons. But he educated Jefferson Davis's three boys.
He had a small school in his home.
And you know where, have you ever been in that church now?
No.
It's worth going into.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that church, as I understand,
was built by the manse, whatever you call it, the rectory, was built by Mrs. Fairfax Harrison, whose husband was the president of the Southern Railway. And she simply said, build the house to suit yourself and send the bill to me. See, because we're talking now about Southern, you know.
Southern what?
Southern heritage. We don't have her, essentially her background and my background are Southerners, the American Civil War.
But my father was from Chicago and I'm half that.
What do you suggest? What was the question you asked me?
Well, start anywhere and keep going on. This is terrific. So your Jefferson Davis would come here to visit your mother or your grandmother?
My grandmother.
Your grandmother. Yeah. Do you remember anything else that your grandmother told you or your mother told you?
Well, she told me all about, she used to tell me about the 7 days fight around Richmond. Mm-hmm. Because grandfather was company K of the 1st Virginia Cavalry.
Do you remember any details about that story?
The only thing I can remember is she said it was a terrible time. You know, you had the Battle of the Wilderness, as Ulysses S. Grant. You know, somebody said he was a drunk. And you know what Lincoln said? What kind of whiskey does he drink? Because he was a brilliant man. But he became morose because he was separated from his wife. And he was stationed out in the state of Oregon or Washington, a territory at that state of the game. And that's what caused him to drink too much.
This was after the Civil War, well, or before.
He was a marvelous guy.
Which?
This was before the Civil War.
Okay.
Before the Civil War.
And that was Grant.
That was Grant. He taught mathematics, you know, at West Point. He was a brilliant teacher there. It was the old thing of jealousy. And of course you got mixed up with a bunch of crooks up in New York City. You know, Mark Twain helped him write his memoirs. And he wrote it, took him 2 years, and Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens helped him write those, corrected his grammar and all that sort of thing, and he died a week after he finally finished those. And that's a great. Have you ever read Grant's life's work? He wrote it himself.
Did he have a special motive for writing it?
He didn't want his wife to be penniless.
And he succeeded.
And he succeeded. Sure.
The pension system was not as thorough or complete in those days.
Well, you know, at the time, who was the Jew? There were two Jews on our Supreme Court.
Frankfurter?
Yeah, when Frankfurter died, his friends had to take up a collection to sustain Mrs. Frankfurter.
That's a lot more recent than
yeah.
Ulysses Grant.
Oh, sure.
So going back to your family, do you remember any other stories that your grandmother
told you? This was the original road right here that goes by the first railroad in America was 1830, and I remember going down and to the Fair of the Iron Horse, which is held at Relay, Maryland.
Fair, F-A-I-R.
Yeah, the Fair of the Honor. It was like a World's Fair for railroads.
And what year was that about?
1830. It was the first railroad in America.
But when did you go to the fair? Not 1830.
I was about 8 or 9 years old. And I remember grandfather used to get in his horse, and he would go right down this road, right down to where all that flooded area down there. That was the most beautiful place down in that valley.
You're talking about Atkinson Lake.
That's right. And they flooded it because they needed enough water to make chlorine and mustard gas, because they didn't know whether Adolf Hitler, being the sort of cuss he was going to gas our troops. And of course, World War I, had caused all the terrible gas industries, you know. And so they flooded that down there. But I remember he used to go right down through where the Pentecostal place, because Pentecost was a lawyer lived up in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia. And this was his summer home. And I remember when I was a 14-year-old boy, I went down there and he had all these friends down from Pennsylvania. And I let all the air, along with the Chilcote boys, we let all the air out of the tires of these people who come down in automobiles.
The guest.
Huh?
The guest.
The guest.
Yes. What fun! What a lark!
Well, yeah, that's right. It was a crazy thing to do. And the Chilcote boys told on me. You know, they said, Mike Crocker did it. And old Penny Patton got in touch with Daddy. And Daddy said, you get on your best clothes and you go down there right now and apologize. And I did. And the Pentecostal girls, three girls and a boy, they were in the dining room listening to my apologies.
And they were as guilty as you were.
No. Not the Pentecostals.
Oh.
They were Isaac A. Pentecostal, who was a gorgeous summer home. And that's all changed.
Do you know that house?
No, I don't.
Do you know Harford Glen?
Yeah, do you?
Well, this is the stone house in Harford Glen, which was originally inhabited by Pennypackers from Philadelphia as a summer home.
You,
I do know that house.
And when you looked out there, I can remember going down there as a child, running all over that place down there.
And what was his reaction to your apology? Did he accept your apology?
He accepted it. He understood what went on. I had to get somebody down here and pump the tires up, you know.
This is just boyhood orneriness.
Yeah, boyhood orneriness. And Pierce and Diddy, there were four Chilcotes and Mike Crocker. And they said Mike Crocker did it. And so Mr. Penny, they lived just across the street, over the street there. Remember, I was at Dolores, not Dolores, Mildred, who's in my class. You remember, I represented her husband in that case when his hand was cut off. And when Rosa said, Daddy's in Detroit, you remember that? And it was a drop press down at the Martin Company. He was defective and cut his hand off. And Oscar, I forget Oscar's name, badly had damaged his hand. And they're still alive. They live down in Florida now. But that was the Chilcotes. Chilcotes is a well-known name in Maryland. That came from over in Baltimore County.
What else do you remember about being a boy in this area?
Well, of course, down over the hill. I remember that very clearly, the Whitaker's Mill, right down at the bottom of the hill. I remember swimming in the, they had a horse trough. You see, we were right at the fall line. Here, you had all these dams that went along. You had Whitaker's Mill Dam, you had Hollingsworth Dam, you had Bell's Dam, and there were two or three other. There were dams all over the place. And you hit tidewater as soon as you get through the fall line. And we were right at the fall line. And I used to fish in all these. I'd fish down in Hollingsworth Dam, I'd fish in Bell's Dam, I'd fish in Whitaker Mill Dam, and Whitaker Mill, you can go down there right now and look at, you know, how the, you can see the, where the undershot water wheel went through, and I used to swim in that horse trough down there. That horse trough was, it must have been this wide, about as long
about
as...
About 2.5, 3 feet? Or?
Yeah, about 2.5 to 3 feet. It was just ideal. Water, you know, spring water coming right out. I mean, the spring in this place right here.
Our spring
is the only spring house like it. I take it down and show it to you.
Most spring houses are rectangular boxes made of stone. This one is shaped like a Quonset hut with a barrel vault roof and two flat ends.
Stone. Are you familiar with the with the term a hydraulic ram. It's this house, when I was a boy, had gravity flow. We heated this house with chunk stoves.
Chunk stoves.
Yeah.
Tell me about those. What are they like?
Well, you heat the house in the wintertime with a stove into which you put wood, and the smoke goes up the chimney there, and it goes up the chimney out here, and it goes up the chimney all the way in the back. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was no...
So there are three fireplaces.
There are more than that. There's a second floor fireplace here. And I can remember all that very, very well. And there was no electricity here. And I remember the first telephone in this place. We were on the A10F line, A10F21, two longs and a short. We were the A10F line, and the 21 was our ring. Two longs and one short, the two longs and then the short. And mother could butcher hogs, so can Aunt Claire, and so can Aunt. This place, it was 645 acres, and I remember that field out there. When I was a small boy, it was just because grandfather was an orchardist. And that was all apples out there. And I, as a matter of fact, I've got this orchards around here. And she kids me. She says, "Why don't we sell this?" I said, "Do you want some guy who is one of the senior partners in the largest firm in Baltimore selling fruit?"
My answer is yes. No. He loves to have the fruit. He loves to eat it. He himself cans and bottles.
Yeah, last year
and then he loves to give it away.
379 quarts of fruit. And I'll do it this year. And that's the best fruit you can get.
These are apples? What are you?
We've got blueberries. We got peaches and nectarine. We've got pears. And we have apples.
And plums.
And not a very good crop this year.
And pears.
And we take all of the apples. And my grandfather, and I can remember, there were cherry trees here. I can remember my brother and I climbing up a cherry tree and going out to the end to get waxheart cherries. And we turned around and here came a black snake looking for us. We got the hell out of there. We dropped off the limb. But grandfather that was his occupation. He was an orchardist. And there are a lot of fancy trees around here, right? The tree out here in the yard is a Chinese larch. It's Moses, college roommate's father, when he came up here, held his cane up and he said, "That is a deciduous conifer. It loses its needles," and so many people say, they'll come in there, but among the feet, they just fall and come out the next spring. But that's what this place was like in those days. And I hated it. The reason I asked you about a hydraulic ram, the principle is this, that it's got a one-way valve in a great big closed container that sits on the top. And every act of the pump, and it is, you've got a level here of a spring coming out of the ground. Then below that you've got the spring house in which there is a reservoir. And on down below that, and that's probably separated by the height of this room down there below the spring.
About 12 feet?
Yeah, about that. And as the water goes down from the spring, it goes into the reservoir, and from the reservoir, it goes on down to a pit. And in the bottom of that pit is the hydraulic ram. And it's got a one-way valve in it, and to every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And the way it works is
that reaction coughs 6/7 of the water out, and 1/4 of it is pumped up. And up in the top of this house were two great big bats. They were about that big around.
6 feet? 5 feet? It's about 6 feet or 5 feet around?
No, more than that. I expect those, well, they would be 6 feet across,
right.
I guess. And so you had a gravity flow. And I hated to go down. You had to go down and turn off the ramp, and you had to go down into that pit. And I always wondered whether there was going to be a copperhead snake down in there and so on.
Well, the descendants of the snakes are still around, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. I was just sitting out here the other day when you were away, you know, writing a letter. And I looked around, here came a black snake coming through the house.
Through the house?
Yeah.
In here?
Oh, yeah. Mother, I can remember, Mother used to, are you familiar with a bucket a day? It's a way to heat hot water, and you have a little thing like a furnace that's about this high.
2.5 feet about?
Yeah, about that high. And then you have a 50-gallon tank up above it, and you had hot water all during the summertime. So when the furnace or the temp stoves weren't working, and Mother would go down and attend it because she wanted hot water.
Mm-hmm.
And she picked up the little top where the coal was kept and she got up, and there was a big old black snake curled all the way around this tank, keeping warm,
mm-hmm,
under the circumstances.
Not on the warpath at all.
Oh no, the black snake is called the farmer's friend, because he can kill a poison snake. A poison snake can't kill a constrictor.
Mm-hmm.
Constrictor will ultimately win, and they eat, you know, like, have you ever been to look at a boa constrictor that have a half a pig in it, and they won't eat anything for 6 more months,
mm-hmm,
and it goes along, and like, the black snake's the same way. So you were asking about, my mother and her two sisters, they could cook anything. I mean, they made sauerkraut, you know, that's the way. It used to be in this country,
3%. Show anything.
Yeah, and 3% of the population used to be 66% produced the food for America. Now only 3% produce the food for, mm-hmm, all of America.
And for export as well.
That's correct.
Machines have made the difference.
So what do you remember about their cooking? They must have been doing canning and so forth just the way you do now.
Oh, yeah. My mother used to make sauerkraut, put it in the cellar, and we had one of these big crocks. And of course, it's the worst thing if you got a high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want it to taste very good. And we always had it with the Thanksgiving dinner and Christmas dinner.
No other times?
Huh? No. Generally, that was essentially the time when you had it. And they used to cook all sorts of things.
Was the sauerkraut served hot or cold?
It was hot when it was served, but it had, you know, you put a layer of salt and a layer of vinegar and cure it, ultimately. And it takes a while, I don't know the process, but they could do anything. My grandmother, my aunt, ran up a tea house right up there in Bel Air. And she could...
The Graham Crocker House,
yeah.
30 North Main.
Yeah. They were both were Pew sisters, but one married a Graham and one married a Crocker.
Mm-hmm.
We boarded with Michael's mother when he first finished law school, and we moved back to Harford County, and he had a job in Baltimore with the law firm in there. So I was trying to be a polite daughter-in-law, and I would go and say to my mother-in-law while she was fixing the food, "What can I do to help you?" She would say, "Go in the other room." She knew how to do it. Not that she didn't appreciate my offer, but...
The kitchen was her domain.
She knew exactly what to do.
But that's the way it was. I mean, I think about your mother before milk was pasteurized. She didn't like to...
My mother grew up not liking milk, because when she was a child,
Oh, it was not pasteurized, it tastes like onions.
And as a consequence, she was a fine horsewoman, but she had osteoporosis.
Eventually, not early, but yeah. late in life.
But she had three of her vertebrae were gone. Mm-hmm.
Michael thinks it's a good chance because she didn't drink milk when she was a child. But a lot of people don't drink milk when they're children. We went visiting in New Zealand to some friends there, and after we'd been there for a while, our hostess said, "Is there anything you would like?" I said, "I am perishing for some milk." She said, "You like milk?" I said, "We drink it all the time." She said, "Well, of course, New Zealand, you know, is a very famous dairy country, as well as famous for its sheep as well." But she was surprised that I like to drink milk, and that's what it comes to. And she said, "Well, we consider milk as for babies and old people." They didn't even give milk to their school children, and they grew up perfectly well.
Yeah, a lot of cultures reject milk as well. So what else do you remember about your mother and her living in this house? And
well, tell her about what she said to the man who was running for office.
Oh, these roads didn't have a hard bottom in them. And when they,
a hard bottom?
You mean yeah.
A base?
Daddy, when he was a Ford dealer here, he had three cars stuck between here and Bel Air. Because when the spring thaw came and then they would refreeze and so on, and you couldn't, they had no hard bottom.
They were impassable with the car.
Right. As a matter of fact, I'm just about to have this lane redone.
Not macadamized.
Not, huh?
Not macadamized.
No. Because it doesn't have a hard bottom.
And so this has to do with the fellow that was going to be elected or was running for office?
Oh, the story about your mother.
Yeah, that was that the road or electricity?
Road.
And mother got back to the county commissioners. And that's the way the county used to be run, by five county commissioners. And we were in the third district here. And she said, I've got, she named the number of people on, she said, "I've got 10 votes down there, 20 votes down here, they're all yours if you'll pave this road." And they paved the road.
And who was that? Do you remember?
My mother.
I know, but who was the man that she was?
I'm trying to think who would have been, it would be Clyde Spencer, I think. Clyde Spencer. It's now dead. Do you know where, is it the C-Mart?
Is what the C-Mart?
The land right up where Ronnie's Liquor is.
Oh yes, that's C-Mart.
The next house up is Clyde Spencer, and he was the county commissioner.
What else do you remember about your childhood here?
Want to tell about the school?
Oh yeah. I used to go to school in a buggy. And they had school buses. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, when I graduated from high school, the principal of school used to spank bad boys in high school. "Miller, you better behave yourself." And if I had done what so many of these kids do, I would have gotten a lot more held from my parents than I would have gotten from the school principal.
Just the opposite now.
Oh, that's just crazy.
The school people have a hard time getting the parents to back them up with their children very often. I've heard this.
Well, my civil rights, nobody ever talks about civil responsibilities. Just civil rights.
But you were on a track, a winning track team too, weren't you?
Oh yeah. Those were great guys, too. One is Charlie Irwin, one is Jack Archer, one... Charlie Irwin, they owned... what is that area called up there?
the misery when fell on the fire, she was a white song and burned herself to death. You know where the giant food is? Well, right across the road, back of where Ruth Pugh lived, that was the Irwin farm. And she and mother they'd gone to school together. The Wysongs was one of the very oldest families here in the county.
I asked Michael's mother once, speaking of that area, I said, this is called Tollgate Road. Tell me about the tollgate. And so she did. There was a small stone house right on the corner of Route 1 and Tollgate Road.
It was on
the side where the mall is.
That was the county fairground.
The little toll gate house was where the toll gate keeper lived, and he was the son of an English nobleman who came over here because he had not inherited the family estate in England, so he kept the toll gate. And I asked Michael's mother, I said, how much was the toll? That was horses coming from Baltimore down the called the Bel Air Road, and in Bel Air called the Baltimore Pike. Same road was the direction I'd be going. But she said, oh, it was 2 cents a horse. And she said, but we never paid it. We just cut through Mr. Edgar Durham's orchard.
To avoid the toll.
2 cents a horse. Don't you think that's interesting?
I remember so well, right there, right alongside of the toll house, was old Combs's store.
And what kind of store?
Hmm?
What kind of store was that?
It was like a country grocery store.
Okay.
Like a so general many. Store.
So many of them.
Like a general store.
That's right. But it had the aroma. I remember, let's see, right there where... Ford Agency was where the Bel Air Blueprint.
Copy Center.
And Copy Center. That is.
On Main Street?
Yes.
On Main Street.
Just in the next block down.
Whenever I go in there, I look up and look at that ceiling, and it's still the same stamped.
Metal?
Metal ceiling in there. It was in Daddy, when Daddy owned the place.
I'll be darned. Good. And haven't gotten rid of everything.
What do you remember about the general store you were going to say?
Mr. Woodley Richardson. Let me see. Do you know, I believe, all changes so fast. John the Barber was, it's a very valuable piece of land right at that intersection of Churchill Road and Main Street, Bel Air. And I think that land is now owned by the guy up here that lives on the corner, Tollgate Manor. That's a very valuable piece of land. And I think the big builders out of Baltimore, the Knotts, K-N-O-T-T. They're very large and very successful. Three brothers. Each one of them had about 12 children apiece. And they have their headquarters is down there. As you go around the Bel Air Belt, the Baltimore Beltway, on the left of the Knott Industries. And they have extremely successful, the Knott brothers.
They were very well known.
That's right. Very well known. Very, and the Mullins and the Knotts.
When you all wanted to go to Baltimore when you lived here as a child, how did you get there? And did you go often?
Should start recording. You remember?
Going up to New York to Aunt Bertha Miller. Because Tony Sard, who was one of the great puppeteers of America, had and I would go up on the train, the B&O train, and we would go across on the ferry to Manhattan. and on up and spend time with Anne Brooker Miller.
In Baltimore?
In New York.
Oh, in New York, right.
Yeah. Okay. And grandfather used to go down on the train, take his horse and buggy. He would go down and park the horse and buggy at Van River on the B&O Railroad. Mm-hmm. And he'd get on the railroad and go in and come out at the end of the day, and he had a big stalk of bananas. Because all that area down there, that's Harbor Place, that's where all the produce came in. It's all, that's so drastically changed now.
He went down there and bought bananas from the...
Bought bananas, he stalked bananas and hang them in the cellar here. I remember I was in the Marine Corps in World War II. Same thing happened. When I was on Guadalcanal, you know, you take a stalk of bananas. Mm-hmm. You're familiar with a banana tree?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they grow like this, yeah, you know, yeah. Exactly so. And we used to take, when I was in the tropics, and you just get a stalk of bananas, you dig a slip trench alongside of your tent. When we were in a campaign, you know, we were either on Guadalcanal, going up to Bougainville, or we were at Guam, and we would dig it right along. We had primed tents lived in, two officers per tent. You could just, I don't drink or smoke, and in the Marine Corps you sort of expect to drink and so on. And I'd bear the bananas there in a slit trench about that wide, and cover them over with a poncho. And in the middle of the night, if I wanted some refreshments, they ripen fairly. You know, bananas are, they ripen fairly fast. But you can slow the ripening process. So it's the same sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, ma'am.
Bibi.
Well, I don't want to bore you here.
You are far from boring me. This is terrific.
He's the real McCoy.
I could organize all this a lot better.
Well, would you like to wait, pause this for a second? Tell me about
Henry
mm-hmm.
Crocker went to Washington, Italy for a time after he got out of high school, and he has had at least 2 years worth of college courses, both at Washington, Italy and at Johns Hopkins as a part-time student. He was pursuing his education after high school, but when their father died, he came home to take care of their mother.
Mm-hmm.
And then the war came along, and he went into the Navy.
That would have been World War II.
Yes.
World War II.
Yeah,
he was a petty officer.
The war.
He was drafted. He was a petty officer. And he can remember Admiral, I'm trying to figure his name. Commander Kramer, he said, I could see him now in his hand going from the old Navy Department right across Constitution Avenue and running right up to the White House to give the first 13, because they had broken the code.
The first 13
paragraphs of the Declaration of War after Tora, after the bombs were dropped on Pearl Harbor.
And the younger brother, Dorsey, was in Coast Guard, but he's younger and he was not in World War II.
So those people, they know all that.
Yeah, I'll definitely get in touch with them. Tell me about going to Washington, Lee. You were saying it cost you how much a year?
$785 a year.
And that includes your tuition and your room?
Everything. I used to hitchhike back and forth all the way. I had no money.
He earned his room and board almost the whole way through by doing different kinds of work.
You know,
serving as a counselor in the dormitory, he got his room.
So, and then I worked at the Dutch Inn, and the lady owned it. His father was the federal judge, and he borrowed a suit and went down to Richmond to ask Lee to become president of Washington, Lee. It's all changed. You're from down there.
Yeah. And when we say the war, I shouldn't say this on tape. When we say the war, we mean the Civil War.
Well, we do too.
Sure.
often.
And people, you know, they say, you know,
it was so long ago.
That's right. I can remember grandmother telling me all about it.
And growing up in Lexington certainly made it seem very much still alive.
I remember my first professor, my freshman English professor, was Dr. Moffat. And Mrs. Moffat was the historian general of the United Daughters of the Confederacy, the UDC. And Tim Lamboid, who died rather recently, he was a wag, and he was...
Washington Lee classmate.
Yeah, he was a year ahead of me. And he said, old Mrs. Moffat, and she was down presiding over the chapel where he was buried. Old Mrs. Moffat sat on the top of it, running the UDC. She began to think and ask, thinking was Lincoln, and forgot about Robert E. Lee. And he was a writer for the Southern Collegian, which was the
college magazine.
It wasn't the magazine, it was the literary effort. Yeah, he was a wise, he was a great guy.
And nearly got expelled. Can you imagine how strict they were then?
That incident nearly got him expelled?
Oh, yeah. He was
disrespect for a faculty wife.
Severely reprimanded. And, and Mrs. Charlie McDowell, he comes on Washington Regional Review. His father was a professor of law down there, and I used to go, Ms. McDowell, I always went to the University of Virginia in Washington Lee to recruit guys to go to Piper Marbury.
So law firm.
Yeah. And Charlie was a little guy he was running around in short pants when you were growing up down there.
He was several years younger, yes. Yeah. Faculty children together. A different world.
So tell me, I would very much like to come back another time
we'll come back.
But tell me about the biggest changes you've seen in Harford County.
Oh, well, the biggest changes is too damn many people, first of all.
That's not talking about you.
I understand.
No, I mean, it's too many people on this little planet. That's all it comes to. And as I say, when I think, for instance, over there, the Curtises, right there where the Mountain Road and Harvard Road cross, right to the rock, that was Curtis's. And I've got the one of the books around here is the way the old people lived at those times. You know, Mother went to church in a horse and buggy. And I used to go to the school.
You don't expect her to continue to do that when cars come along, though, do you?
No, but you know, the Model T Ford was the first automobile in America.
You're just talking about the rate of change.
The rate of change. It's just like your mother, you know.
When we were children, an airplane would fly over and everybody in town would run out and look up.
So it changes.
Well, one way I have written to my friends to illustrate the changes. It used to be that you could just, you know, drive uptown for an errand. Now you've got 6 traffic lights going the route that has the least number of traffic lights between here and the courthouse. The number of schools so dramatically increased is one thing that I'm aware of because of my involvement with the school concerts program. And the tremendous increase in pressure on public services. I don't think new people have any idea the strain and the expense and the difficulty of continuing to provide proper public services, schools, roads, police, health, and all the others. they couldn't appreciate the very great difficulty to keep funding all the new things that are necessary. I talked to a lady once who lived in Joppatown, and she was complaining. This was many years ago, when Joppatown was first built. And she was complaining because they didn't have a library branch there. She said, well, where I came from, we had a public library. And I said, well, why did you move here? She said, oh, the taxes are so low. I said, do you have any children in school? Yes, three. I said, how much are your taxes? And she quoted me a figure such as, you know, $350 a year, property taxes. And I said, well, I happen to know, because I belong to the League of Women Voters, that it costs something like, oh, let's say, $1,500 a year to educate one child in the public school, and you've got three. Now, you're talking about $4,500 right there, let alone the health services and the roads and the court system and everything else that public money has got to support. I said, whose responsibility do you think it is to pay for the education of your children? She said, I never thought of it that way. I said, well, please do. That's my speech.
This is what your husband was talking about, civil responsibilities in addition to the civil rights.
Well, at least don't complain about the library. Get out there and help work for one.
Well, you know, I can remember the first library in Bel Air. It was run by Courtney Stearns' aunt, Miss Lil Forward. And was right down there opposite the armory. And there was the Bel Air Public Library, not what it is today.
Well, what was it like? Was it?
Well, it was a home down there, and she undertook, and I don't know whether she got any help from the county commissioners or so on, but there it was. You know, we were fortunate. We were fortunate in Baltimore. Baltimore had the biggest open stack library in the United States.
Yes, that's one of the biggest features of the Enoch Pratt Library System. I'm sure you're aware that the open stacks are very unusual. Well, they used to be. I don't know whether they still dare have them open stack, do they?
Oh, no. Yeah. Oh, they're having all sorts of problems down there.
But it used to be.
But,
and one of the glowing features of the public library.
And Wheeler, when I was in Baltimore, you see, Baltimore City College was, first of all white when I went there. And remember Gary Moore, I went there, and that was the Baltimore City College that sits up there above the stadium on 33rd Street was the finest public building built in the United States in 1929. And I remember going down when I was 12 years old, and they had a swimming pool in that place, a 50-yard swimming pool. Nobody. And I remember Gary Moore used to get up and entertain us. Gary just died, because Gary used to sell trees on the corner of Cold Spring and Charles.
Did you ever hear of him?
Gary Moore?
No.
Oh, he was one of the great entertainers.
Radio, I see.
Oh, that's right, and more than that. And he would get up, and he was a naturally funny guy, and he would get up and entertain all 2,900 of us until Dr. Philip A. Edwards. And it's the first time I learned what Philip meant. It meant the lover of horses. And he was teaching you all the time. And Gary would entertain it until Dr. Edwards came in to make the morning announcements.
Every morning they
had to 2,900 guys. You know, Baltimore City College, you know, it's the second oldest public high school in America. Oh, yeah. And Baltimore had a marvelous education system. A marvelous one. I mean, look at
that. And people come here to escape that system, which is not marvelous, and would love to be, and is trying hard, but hasn't achieved it.
Well, it's extraordinary. If you look at the 10 best art schools in America. One of them is the Mental Institute for the Arts. Right up there above Mount Royal Station.
Isn't it called Maryland Institute of Art?
I don't know what it's called. I know what it is, but it's one of the 10 best in America. And of course, I remember my father going down watching the Baltimore Fire.
The Baltimore Fire?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that was
1904.
It burned for 12 days, I think it was. It burned right up to where the old Southern Hotel is. I'm trying to think where the Merchants Club is on Redwood Street, which used to be called German Street. And in World War I, the first American killed was named Redwood. And they didn't want anything to do with the Germans, so they named it Redwood Street after John Redwood, who was killed in World War I.
What do you remember your father telling you about the Baltimore Fire?
He'd take his lunch and go down and watch it burn. It took it 8 days. And it burned right up to the corner of Redwood and Coward Street. And the last building standing was the first building in which I practiced law. And it's the building is still there right now. And right behind it is the old Southern Hotel, and I don't know what the hell to do with it. And of course the eating places that you had in the city of Baltimore in those days. Baltimore, you see, used to be an insurance center for the United States. It was, there were more hats made in Baltimore. It was a great clothing center. And it had some of the finest eating places you ever want to go to. The Renard Hotel and what's the hotel that's right there on the Mount Vernon Place? I used to take you there occasionally to eat. You remember when we got on the bay, on the old bay boat, and we went down to Norfolk?
With some friends and our children. And put the babies in the bathtub so they wouldn't roll out.
And of course, in those days, you know, to go across the Chesapeake Bay to Talchester. Have you seen any of these things gone but not forgotten?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what comes out on PBS in Baltimore. And they sent us several copies, and I sent one to each one of our children.
We very much enjoyed Avalon. Mm-hmm. That movie, did you happen to see that? Remember?
It was
about the Jewish family, the history of the family, and how things changed for them over the years.
Well, you know what Avalon means. That's the ideal. That's the ideal way to live. You know, the Avalon Peninsula up there, when we went down on it and out to Saint-Pierre and Miquelon. And it's a well-known song that you all know, tune and song. You were talking about it, your book club was talking about Avalon. She was going to make a report on it. Eloise Wilson. You with me?
I'll have to remember. No, I don't recall right this minute. Hartford County.
Yeah, you were going to tell me about some of the changes.
Well, his track team at Bel Air High School, it's different now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we built our own track. Jimmy Kehoe, Jack Archer, Jimmy and Jack, and Charlie Irwin and Mike Crocker. We had to run in the Penn relays, and we were beaten by that much, 2 years running, so to speak, at the Penn relays, which was was the original relay track meet in the whole of the United States. It's the oldest track meet in America. And we would go up there to Franklin Field, and they would pit us against Knott Terrace that was connected to New York that had 2,900 students in it. And we only had 10, and we only had 300 up here. And we built our own track.
And you came that close to beating them.
That's right. Yeah,
really. How did you build the track?
With your muscle. We got cinders, and you know, a bunch of boys in there after it.
They had a good leader.
Yeah.
What was his name?
He was Philip Bird Hopkins. He was related to Johns Hopkins University. And he was very interested in boys. I remember our track team served as Heidi's when Heidi died at when he was, because that was our last year in high school. I was 16 when I graduated. And Jimmy and Charlie, Charlie went, and he was, they all went to England. Jack, I don't think, was in World War II. But Charlie was along with the Pasmacomas, and that's why he married, you know, she's here in the nursing home, and she was, her husband was World War, was in the RAF and was killed, shot down at the time.
Speaking of Marguerite McComas, Preston's wife.
Right. And that's how she happened to marry Press, and Press brought her back here as a British war bride.
So, but they built their track. That was kind of interesting, you know. And did you win a local championships, even if you didn't beat Knott Terrace at the pin relay?
Well, sure. Jock was the state champion in the quarter mile, and Jimmy ran the fastest half mile in America in 1940, and I'm sure he would have gone to the Olympics. He was at the University of Maryland, and his track teams never lost a dual meet.
When he was coaching?
When he was coaching.
And why didn't he go to the Olympics?
Because Adolf Hitler wouldn't let us have the Olympics. Poe's father was in the 1912 Olympics, and he went to the 1936 Olympics, and he wanted to come home on the Hindenburg.
You know what that was?
Do you remember up at Lakehurst, New Jersey? Yeah. So you would have been had a mother as a widow.
Sooner than I did.
So how did he, what happened to keep him off the Hindenburg?
I'm not sure.
He couldn't get a ticket.
Probably. It was a very popular flight, of course. And but he came home by ship. I doubt if he flew. Many people didn't fly the Atlantic in a commercial transportation much in those days.
Well, you remember Jimmy, I remember when Lindbergh flew the Spirit of St. Louis.
And so Jimmy, do I.
And Jimmy...
2 years younger.
And Jimmy's mother named her child Charles Lindbergh Kehoe.
Well, it was thrilling.
Oh, it was.
Absolutely, a thrilling thing, you know, you can imagine.
And I remember, you know, trying to work a radio. I remember my father had what was called a crystal set. Mm-hmm. And you wore earphones, you know. And you would get KDKA from Pittsburgh.
To listen to the Lindbergh account, is what you're saying?
Well, no, you would just listen to all sorts of things. I mean, those were the good old days of Amos and Andy, you know, who weren't black men, but they, and I was talking to a black man going in, he agreed with me, I'd go in and pick him up because he's from Mississippi, he comes out here, works around, helps us and so on, and I'd go in and pick him up and bring him out from Parkville, and he just loves that countryside.
What did he say about Amos and Andy? Was that
He loved.
Did.
Oh, sure.
That's interesting. I'm glad he did.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know. Yeah. As your mother said, the black people of the South taught the white people good manners. The people who live in the North, they don't care anything about the black people.
They pretend they do.
Huh? Or they
What is your experience
with
the difference in the way black people are treated in the South and the North?
Well, let me pause the